Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, and welcome everyone to History Dweebs. I'm Tim, and today's topic is on Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, one of the leading silent film actors of the early 20th century and famous comedian, who also was involved in Hollywood's first major, scandal. And so we're going to talk about that, but before we do, let me introduce my co-host here, the incomparable, debonair, and all-around nice guy, Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as the Southern Gentleman. How are you, Colonel?
Well, I'm wonderful. Thank you for such a kind introduction, Timmy.
Well, you know, I always try to give you a very good introduction, but sometimes when... you know, who is here, it makes it difficult. She wants to chime in, and she says negative things. But
and your listeners out there, you might be sitting there with a smile on your face thinking, oh, I don't have to put up with an hour of the devil this time.
That's right. Brandy is not here today. She will be here on our next podcast, but Brandy is, I think she's worshiping Satan today.
She's actually, Brandy is under house arrest. She has a ankle bracelet on.
Oh, I didn't know.
She will be able to join us on our next podcast. Hopefully, young Brittany is, she's finishing up that 12th step.
Yeah, I think she's on step 15 of the 12 step program.
Have you got an apology where she makes amends?
Not yet.
I have not yet either.
I'm waiting for that.
I am waiting for one, too.
One of the 12 steps is that the person has to make amends for all the harm they've caused others.
Yeah.
And I keep waiting. So maybe...
set an entire day aside for the girl to make amends with me.
The problem is that she's stuck on that step. She's going
that,
around,
that could be.
You know, she's got a lot of...
She's trying to remember. The girl drinks a little bit. She don't remember what she did all the time.
She does. And then, you know, she sends a lot of drunk texts.
She absolutely does. We got a couple shout-outs we'd like to give today, Timmy. There's been some people leaving some nice comments on our page. And one, I want to get this right because I want to say Anna. It's just with one N, S.
So you don't think it's Anna?
Anna. It's really tough when you just get the spelling, but I'm going to go with Anna.
It's A-N-A.
Yeah. And it could be Anna. I mean,
she left a very nice comment for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's from Texas, the great state of Texas, where I've only been one time. I've been down to San Antonio to the Riverwalk, seen the Alamo, which is a... You ever been to the Alamo?
No, I've been to Dallas, I've been to Houston, and I've been to El Paso.
The Alamo is a very, very strange thing because you hear about it all the time, and it's very small. It's a small, it's very small, and it's in the middle of the, right near the Riverwalk, so everything's built up around it. You right. always expect it to be out in the middle of the desert, and it's kind of like here and over the Rhine, the Alamo's right here. And
right in the middle of town.
Yeah, what I took away, what I just could not believe, I'd always been fascinated by the Alamo, and I could not believe it was the size it was.
Yeah,
you know, but much like Gettysburg, I went to Gettysburg, and it was the same way.
I went to Graceland. It was the same way. I was expecting, Graceland, of course, where Elvis was born, not where he was born, but where he lived. And I was expecting this huge, opulent, mansion, and it was nice and all. But
it's basically an upscale suburban house.
Yeah,
is what it is.
Huge. Yeah.
With some crazy ass furniture in it.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. And Anna, thank you very much for your kind comments.
Thank you very. And we also had a very nice one from Celine C. in Waverly, Michigan. Now, Celine, we did kind of creep your Facebook page a little bit to find out where you're from, because we did not want to give your last name out of where you are.
Yeah.
So she's from Waverly, Michigan. I will tell you, Timmy, now this, you know, Michigan is my favorite state.
It is, I know. You vacation there every summer.
Every summer, we find a cabin on a lake, Lake Michigan, and it truly, it's the prettiest place that I've ever been in the country. I love that place. So, Selena, we appreciate your feedback. And like I said, even if it's negative.
Hers was positive.
But we definitely appreciate it. It's nice to hear, because I do this for free. Timmy's making some money off of it, I believe.
I'm not making a dime. You have the IRS all over. I am not making a dime off of it.
So thank you very much.
Yeah, and you make a good point, because that's kind of our pain. I mean, this is kind of our what we get out of this is we get comments. That's what we like. We like feedback from the listeners, either positive or negative, but we prefer positive, of course. But when we get some feedback on iTunes or on Facebook about one of our podcasts, we quickly text each other about it. So if you think you're making a comment and no one's reading it, you're wrong. We're all over it. As soon as we get a comment, we are sharing it with each other. So if you like our podcast, we would greatly appreciate if you could leave a comment on iTunes, a review on iTunes, because the more of those we get, the easier it is for potential listeners to find us on iTunes. So that's what we really stress. But if you want to leave us a comment on our Facebook page, we'd love that too. Just look up History Dweebs on Facebook. But again, if you could take a couple minutes, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and leave us a message, totally free, only takes a minute, but it would mean so much to us.
It does. You know, we do these shows, and like you said, we're not getting paid. And we spend, each show I'm spending a good 15, 20 minutes researching and preparing.
whole 20 minutes.
Yeah, 15, 20 minutes researching and
preparing. Well, you have so much, you have so much knowledge already.
I just want to make sure that I got things.
Right.
Now
for Brandy, it's always new. I mean, it's like she's reading a newspaper.
With Brandy, Brandy's like a newborn baby.
Yeah.
her brain is, she's much like a blank slate. So every time
we have to get these shots in at her while she's not here.
Because she would shank us if she were here.
Yes,
she's a dangerous woman.
She is very dangerous, but she's out at home worshiping Satan,
and on the ankle bracelet.
She's got an ankle bracelet on for multiple felonies, I'm sure. But anyway, she'll be joining us on our next podcast. But let's get in. Let's talk about. You got to say, give a shout out to my mom.
Of course, we're going to give a shout out to Dottie Scott. Dottie, we actually, and the truth be told, we do these podcasts truly to just entertain Dottie. That's what we do.
For anyone else that listens,
everybody else is a bonus.
The other 13,000 people are listening.
Yeah,
we love it. We're glad you're listening.
We
do really
these things to entertain Dottie, because she is a wonderful follower. She's a wonderful supporter. She's a And occasionally, I'll get very me, Timmy. I'm on Facebook, and we did an experiment one time, because they were joking about me that I could put up a picture that made no sense whatsoever. And I put up a picture of a sign going down the steps, and I forget what it said. It just said steps here.
Please use handrail.
And I believe we got about 60 likes on that.
Yeah, comments, people interpreting it.
Yeah,
it was hilarious.
And but I get very excited when Dottie leaves a message on my Facebook page when she comments or whatever. I get very excited.
She was in total agreement with you on the Jesse James podcast. She said that she thought that he had no idea that they were going to kill him, or he would never put his gun down. So I said, okay, you always agree with the colonel.
So thank you for we appreciate your support, Dottie. You're a lovely woman. You went somewhere wrong with Timmy. I don't know what you did with him, but...
Yeah, well, I didn't end up a serial killer yet.
It reminds me of the old Merle Haggard song, Mama Tried.
Yeah, but she
Mama Tried. So
let's talk about Fetty Arbuckle, shall we?
Let's do that.
Okay, so Roscoe, I love that name, Roscoe. Roscoe Conkling Fetty Arbuckle was an American silent film actor, comedian, director, and screenwriter. He was one of Hollywood's biggest stars in the early 20th century. He mentored such future stars as Charlie Chaplin and actually discovered Buster Keaton and Bob Hope. So he, besides his physical appearance, he was big in Hollywood.
And this was the silent movie era.
The silent movie era. He was a silent movie star in the 1910s and 1920s. He soon became the highest paying, one of the highest paying actors in Hollywood. In 1920, he signed a contract with Paramount Pictures for $1 million, which is equivalent to about over $13 million today. So, I mean, that was big money, $1 million in 1920. He was a big, pretty big star. We're going to talk about his life, but he became infamous, I guess, because he got involved in... a scandal in Hollywood. Like we mentioned earlier, probably the first big Hollywood scandal. And it really ruined his career. It's kind of a sad story, and we're going to get into it. And it involves the death of a young lady, Virginia Repay. But anyway, let's talk a little bit first, though, about Fatty and give you some background on him. Fatty, well, he wasn't born Fatty. It wasn't his name when he was born.
I wonder if he was a large child.
He was a large child. Roscoe Arbuckle was born in Smith Center, Kansas on March 24th, 1887. He was one of nine children born to Molly and William Goodrich Arbuckle. At birth, he weighed in excess of 13 pounds. Now, since both of his parents were of slim build, his father did not believe Roscoe was his child. So that created some lifelong friction between his father and himself. And this disbelief of him being his son led to the father naming him Roscoe. He named him after a politician, a notorious philanderer who he just simply hated, a Republican senator by the name of Roscoe Conkling of New York. So he named him Roscoe Conkling Arbuckle. So imagine that, your father naming you after is someone that he just cannot stand. It'd be like you naming one of your child Ted Cruz or something.
Well, yeah, I would never name one of my children Ted Cruz. And I find that interesting because... what did the kid have to do with anything? He didn't do anything wrong.
Well, but you know.
I mean, I guess he represented, he was, you know, if right. You believe. But, you know, two skinny women could have a sure. Large child. Well, or skinny sure. Couple, I'm skinny sure. Women, I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah, two skinny women probably should, couldn't.
Well, yeah, that'd be hard. Yeah, it'd be hard for any woman to give birth to a 13-pound child.
Yeah, now. So the birth was traumatic for Molly, and it resulted in her...
Well, I would think so, yeah.
It resulted in her having chronic health problems, and it contributed to her death just 12 years later. So you've got the child born who... you know, and it would be like your wife giving birth, you know, to, I guess, someone of another race or something, and you're questioning the child being your own. Then you got the fact that she had complications which led to her health problems that led to her death. And so you can imagine this strained relationship between him and his father even more. When Arbuckle was 2 years old, the family moved from Kansas to Santa Ana, California. And the thing about Arbuckle, even though he was a large child, he was very, very agile, and he was actually a pretty good athlete, and he had a wonderful singing voice. At the age of eight, his mother encouraged him to perform on stage at a talent show in Santa Ana. And he did, and took pretty good reviews. He enjoyed performing, continued on performing until his mother's death in 1899, when he was only 12 years old. At that point, when his mother died, his father, I said again, you know, with these questions about paternity and the fact that his birth led to complications, even though it was 12 years later, that took the life of his mother. His father treated him very harshly, and after his mother died, he refused to support 12-year-old Fatty. Fatty, I should probably call him Arbuckle, I feel bad calling him Fatty, but Fatty got a job working odd jobs in a hotel as a young child, and when he worked, he had a habit of singing, and he was overheard by a customer who was a professional singer. And that customer invited Fatty Arbuckle to perform at an amateur talent show. Now, this is back at the turn of the century when there, you know, there were vaudeville, there's all these traveling, different traveling shows going from town to town, and they had all these talent shows. You didn't have TV, you didn't have, you know, motion pictures at that point.
Didn't have no Xbox.
No Xbox.
Don't play no Xbox.
No podcast.
Couldn't get on a World Wide Web.
Could not. So they had these talent shows, and so Fatty signed up for a talent show, and the show consisted of the audience judging acts by either clapping or jeering. Probably like when they're listening to our podcast. For a lot
it's mostly jeering.
Especially when Brandy's
when
talking.
The devil's talking. Well, I wonder this. Because I know I do it, and I've caught Renee doing it. Fast forward and past the devil's part.
Yeah, you know, we need like one of those. It'd be great if we have like they have the use during presidential debates. You know, those meters when people when they like them, don't like them.
Because she'd be in the red.
Oh yeah, she would definitely be always in the red. But anyway, so the audience would judge the acts by clapping or jeering, and these ones that they were used a shepherd's crook. So,
where they'd actually yank you off the stage.
Like the big cane, the crooked cane that they would yank you off the stage. And so Arbuckle was singing and dancing and doing some clowning around during this talent show. He saw the crook emerge from the wings of the stage. And to avoid it, he somersaulted into the orchestra pit. And because he was just obviously, you know, he was in a panic that he was going to get yanked off stage. The audience went wild. They loved it. He ended up winning the talent show contest, and he began his career in vaudeville. So that's how he got started. So, like, he could do no wrong. He screwed up, but the audience loved it. It's kind of like Donald Trump, I guess.
the crazier you are, the more people like it.
I mean, you just get more popular. But anyway, in 1904, I guess he would have been about 17 then, Sid Grauman's theater invited Arbuckle to sing at his new unique theater he had in San Francisco, and it began a long, lifelong friendship between the two. He then joined a popular theater group touring the West Coast of the U.S. and also later on joined a vaudeville troupe. So he was making a living doing this, and he soon became the main act. And really, the group took their show. He became the main character of the group. Kind of like you're the main character of the podcast.
I try to keep my modesty.
I know. But he began to shine. And in 1908, on August 6, 1908, Arbuckle married actress Minta Durfee.
It's unusual that he would marry a woman named Gurfee. Because he was Fatty.
Durfee.
I'm sorry, Timmy. I thought you said Gurfee.
No. Because but she's Minty. Minty Durfee.
Well, how'd you like to be known as Fatty Gurfee?
You wouldn't. Fatty got his name, by the way. He said people called him that in high school. But he also got his name, and they used his name later on in the movies. Because he was obese. I think he was 185 pounds when he was 12 years old.
Holy!
He was huge growing up. Anyway, Durfee was an actress, and she had starred in early comedies, often with Arbuckle when he later on became a film star. But they made it. They did make a strange couple in that Minty was short and petite, while Arbuckle, of course, was very tall and very obese. Arbuckle will then join a Burbank stock vaudeville company. Went on tour to China and Japan in early 1909. So you know he's traveling around. He's making some money. He also began his film career in July of 1909. And he would appear, this is really early on in the film industry, and he would appear sporadically in film shorts until 1913. He moved briefly to Universal Pictures, became a star in those Keystone Cops comedies, yep. Remember the Keystone mm-hmm. Cops? He was earning $3 a day, which is equivalent to about $72 today in today's dollars.
$72 a day, that's a little bit more than we're making here, Timmy.
Yeah, a lot more than we're making doing this. But he was working his way up to, you know, the acting ranks and become a lead player and a director. Although his large size was undoubtedly part of his comic appeal, he was always very self-conscious about his weight. And he refused to use it to get cheap laughs. For example, he would not allow himself to get stuck in a bathtub or in a doorway or a chair, which, you know, would be anything.
Which probably happened to him.
Probably did happen to him, but he wouldn't use that in his act. Again, the thing about it was he was a very talented singer. And mm-hmm. many felt that yeah. he chose the wrong career, that he should give up comedy and become a singer, which he never did. But his singing voice was supposed to have been just incredible, but he started his film career in 1909, and as I said earlier, despite his physical size, he was very agile and athletic. His comedies were noted to being fast-paced. There was many like chase scenes and falling sight gags. So. His favorite was the pie in the face. That was his favorite routine, and of course that was used a lot in the silent era, film era. You can never have too many pie in the face
scenes. No.
I don't care what the movie is, you know. Gone with the Wind. If Rhett Butler
right at the end when yeah. she said, I swear as God is my witness, I will never go hungry again. If he'd have hit her with a pie, it would have been a perfect ending.
Oh, man, he'd had a standing yeah. ovation.
Instead of just saying,
yeah.
you tomorrow's know, frankly, my day. Dear, I don't give a damn.
Right.
Rather, frankly, my dear, here you go. Boom, and hit her with a pie.
It would have been much better. Mm-hmm. I agree. You can never have too many pie to face these. But anyway, Arbuckle at this point was becoming very popular with the audiences, and they were flocking to see his movies. In 1914, Paramount Pictures made the then unheard-of offer to him of $1,000 a day. Now, this is in 1914 dollars. $1,000 a day plus 25% of all profits and complete artistic control to make movies. Now, that is, you know, an incredible contract. The movies were so lucrative and popular that in 1918, they offered him a three-year, $3 million contract would be equivalent to over $43 million today. Again, three-year contract worth today's dollars, $47 million. That's pretty good scratch.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. You eat a lot of food with that.
You could eat a lot of pie.
Yeah, you can. So by 1915, Arbuckle was at the height of his career. I mean, everything was going wonderful for him. By 1916, his weight and his heavy drinking, he was a bit of a carouser, was causing him some health problems. He got an infection in his leg and it became so severe that doctors at one point even considered amputation. Fortunately, Arbuckle was able to get it together. He kept his leg. He lost 80 pounds. And when he lost 80 pounds, he's got his weight down to 266. So
he was up to 350 pounds.
Yeah. But by doing that, he became addicted to painkiller, morphine. So he became addicted to morphine. And this is probably back in the day before you even needed a prescription, I would imagine. But following his recovery from his leg problems, he started his own film company called Communique. So now not only is he an actor, comedian, he's now he owns his own film company, and they produce a lot of these comedy shorts that you would see at the movies in the silent era. But he got an offer from Paramount for $3 million. Another offer in 1918 to make 18 feature films. So he sold his interest, his controlling interest, into his company to Buster Keaton, who went on and developed that company. Arbuckle disliked his screen name. He did not like being referred to as Fatty. That had been his nickname since school, and he just didn't like it. He said it was inevitable because, like I said, when he was 12 years old, he weighed 185 pounds. It was inevitable that he was going to get that nickname. But he really didn't like it, and he would discourage anyone from addressing him as Fatty off the screen. And when they did call him Fatty off the screen, his response was usually, "I've got a name, you know." So he was a little touchy about his obesity. So things are going well for Fatty. He's at the top of his game, but then the scandal happens, and the Colonel's going to tell us about that.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of interesting that you talk about, because Buster Keaton had his own scandal. These were proteges of his.
And so did Charlie Chaplin.
And Charlie Chaplin had his own. Now, where Arbuckle gets into trouble, he had a pretty brutal film schedule. So he decides he's going to take some time off, just a weekend or so. Go up to San Francisco with a couple friends.
And I am going there next week.
You're going to be up there next week?
I'm going to be in San Francisco next week. Any young, attractive, or no, young, attractive, but any attractive women who are in the San Francisco area, email me.
And Timmy, you got to understand, Timmy Young at heart. So you don't have to be young, but you have to be able to keep up with Timmy.
You got
to
be at least 25.
You got to be at least 25, but you got to be able to keep up with Timmy because he got a lot of energy.
Just kidding, everyone.
Like Danny Jazza
Bond. Kind of just kidding. Not really, but...
Well, if you're in San Francisco, give him a shout-out.
Give me a shout-out.
Put a post on the page and Timmy will find you.
I love San Francisco. Beautiful city. But anyway,
I've never been there.
Oh, you have to.
Been to Tijuana, been to San Diego, been to Los Angeles.
Been to Tijuana several times. Yeah. But San Francisco is a beautiful city. So Fatty drives up the coast with a couple friends.
He's got a couple friends and they check into the St. Francis Hotel.
I'm going to find that next week, if it's still there.
I wonder if it is still there. You have to get back with us.
I am. I'll do some research. Search while you're talking.
Now, they rent out three rooms.
they get the whole floor.
Arbuckle and one guy's going to share a room, another guy's going to share a room, and then they rent out 1219, 1220, 1221.
They're going to party.
Yeah, 1220 is empty. It's going to be the party room. So they invite several women up to this suite. Now, during this carousing, this 30-year-old aspiring actress, and back in that day, 30 years old was getting a little long in the tooth, you know, to be an aspiring actress. I mean, these actresses was coming along. They was, you know, 17, 18 years old. But her name was Virginia Rappe.
I just want to mention that there is a St. Francis Hotel down by the Westin. It's on Union Square in San Francisco. I will check it out.
Ask to rent one of the rooms.
I might do that.
Well, in the midst of this party, you got this young woman, Virginia Rappe, and they found her seriously ill in room 1219. And they get the hotel doctor, who thought she was just drunk, you know, so he gave her some morphine to calm her. So she didn't even go to the hospital.
That's my kind of doctor right there.
Yeah. Just give him morphine, calm him down.
Man.
Give him some Benadryl.
I would like for him to be my primary physician, if I can find that guy.
Yeah, but you know, you get hooked on the morphine, and I just saw a thing for painkillers. Now they're prescribing drugs because painkillers apparently block up your intestinal system.
Yeah, because what happens is they're painkillers, so they numb your whole body, which includes your colon, your whole digestive system.
Right? Yeah, and it's so.
But
yeah.
I'll take my chances and
take some extra fiber.
You know what? I would dream. My dream would have been to live like in the 1800s when they had the
opium dens.
The opium dens. Yeah. I want to go to an opium den.
Well, I have to say, the Colonel has always believed that he was born a little. He was born 300 years after he should have been. He was supposed to be a pirate, but if you want to be an opium den, that's true,
I just want to live in an opium den. I never leave. I'll be happy.
Why leave? He could just die there. I mean, why leave? If you're on opium, I don't even think you get hungry.
Put on a little Pink Floyd. What else are there?
What is there? So anyway, I forgot where I'm at. But anyway, they're doing their carousing. Now, Miss Rapace, she gets sick. Now, doctor gives her morphine. Now, the one thing about this woman that you get in here is she was not a person who took care of herself. You know, nowadays, actresses, they're at the treadmill, they're in the gym, they're doing, you know, keeping themselves
fit. She had kind of a rough history, didn't she?
Yeah, well, she did. She was a heavy drinker. And at 30, you would have thought that she wouldn't even be able to be an aspiring actress.
She sounds a little bit like Britney in that aspect of it.
Yeah, but Britney's still got that young glow to her. That's what's odd.
She's very young.
Yeah, but she got a little bit of a problem. And I don't know that it's anonymous anymore, because when you put every drunken picture you have on Facebook and Instagram, you can't be Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So, and I don't even know if she's alcoholic or not. She's crazy drunken girl anonymous is what she is.
She's young.
But anyway.
Can you imagine if we had Facebook when we were in college?
Oh, holy God. Holy God. But her drinking habits, and you got to remember, this is back in the bootleg era, you know, the Prohibition era.
Sure.
So she's, you know, she's drinking a lot of this poor quality liquor.
Hooch.
Hooch. And it gave her... And she developed a reputation for over-imbibing at parties. And then she would do something very weird. Drunkenly tear at her clothes from the physical pain of being drunk. So she had... She also suffered from chronic cystitis that liquor just irritated dramatically. So by the time of the St. Francis party, her reproductive health was just shot. She'd had several abortions in the space of a couple years. Abortion was illegal back then.
So the quality of those.
So she's either, as you said, running down to Mexico, or she's getting some back alley doctor.
Right.
And the aftercare is, it's going to be very substandard. And she kept getting pregnant by the same director, Henry Lehrman. And I don't know why they wouldn't figure that out after a while, but...
He kept hitting it.
He did. And so they finally take her to the hospital. Now, here's where the key player, and here's where the scandal starts, is that at the hospital, Miss Rapace's companion at the party, Bambina Maud Delmont,
She was a troublemaker.
She was a trouble. Well, yeah, we'll get into what she did. She told the doctor that Arbuckle had raped her friend. Now, the doctor examined Miss Rapace and found no evidence at all of rape. Now, Miss Rapace died the next day after a hospitalization of peritonitis. Now, that was caused by a ruptured bladder. And that could have been cancer, could have been any number of things.
Right.
So Delmont then told the police.
But the theory was that because he was on top of her and his weight.
Yeah, crushed her.
Mm-hmm.
So her manager, Rapace's manager, was a guy named Al Simnacker. He had a press conference and accused Arbuckle of using a piece of ice to simulate sex with her, which led to the injuries. Now, this turned into, I mean, by the time it was in the newspapers, it had evolved into being a bottle of Coca-Cola that he had. What they're saying is he actually raped this woman with a piece of ice. Then it turned into he raped her with a Coke bottle. Then it became a champagne bottle.
Got embellished.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just kept getting.
Well, you got to remember, this was a time of yellow journalism in Hearst. I mean, Hearst played a big part in this, so.
We just talked about him during the when the podcast today with Scott on Annie Oakley, and how he had a woman had been arrested for cocaine, and she used the name Annie Oakley, and Hearst ran with the story. And back in those days, every city had multiple newspapers.
Yeah.
So once they would just repeat what they found in other papers, so. And embellish it, and like you said, it was the period of yellow journalism where everything was sensationalized. So this went from he was raping her with a piece of ice, to he was raping her with a Coke bottle, to a champagne bottle.
And witnesses actually testified that what Arbuckle did was he rubbed ice on her stomach to try to ease her abdominal pain. Arbuckle denied any wrongdoing. And Delmont, this lady, she later made a statement incriminating him to the police in an attempt to try to extort money from Arbuckle's attorneys.
Yeah, and she had a history of extorting people, I believe.
Oh, a long history. Yeah.
She saw an opportunity to make some money.
Absolutely. She'd done this earlier. So the prosecutor takes this to the grand jury, and he brings her in to testify, this Maud lady. But at the first trial, he will not use her as a witness But the big winner here, as we were talking about, was Hurst. And he was just a rat son of a bitch. There's no way around it. And Hurst, this is a direct quote from him, that this scandal sold more newspapers than any event since the sinking of the RMS Lusitania.
Yeah, he was known to exploit. You know, a lot of people believe that he had some involvement with the sinking of the USS Maine. For the Spanish-American War, at least capitalizing on it to sell newspapers. What would he say? You
provide the war.
Yeah, you provide the photos. You provide the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, this just destroyed Arbuckle. You know, before the trial even started, he was destroyed. You have morality groups. They were calling him to be sentenced, to be tried and sentenced to death. Studio executives ordered Arbuckle's friends in industry and actors, whose career they were in charge of, to publicly not speak up for him. Now, Charlie Chaplin, he was in England at this time, and Charlie Chaplin by this time is a very powerful man. He's in England, probably with a 14-year-old girl.
He had his own
issues, but he wasn't scared of anybody there. They knew he couldn't do anything, and he's like, you know what? I know him to be a genial, easygoing type who would not harm a fly. Buster Keaton even said, you know, made one public statement in sport, said, I don't believe he could do it. Now, Buster got a reprimand from the studio where he worked.
This is a time when the studios own the actors.
Absolutely.
And if they pretty much had to toe the company line, and they didn't want anything to do with scandal. Now, of course, today, scandal probably sells more tickets
That was a quite a scandalous era back there. Mm-hmm. If the things that were going on now, I mean, you think about Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. That was a big scandal with Angelina Jolie. Right. There was nothing compared to what they was doing back then. But they weren't, they weren't putting that in the newspapers all the time. And a scandal like this, you know,
the morality, was different.
But when you really think about it, Timmy, when you think about Hurst and what he's doing, is it any different? You know, I was thinking about this today. Is it any different than what we see today? What we're supposed to consider news, and it doesn't matter if you're left or right, you can use Fox, MSNBC interchangeably. Mm-hmm. Their first concern, the first priority that they're worried about is what the ratings are.
For sure.
Because it brings money in.
Sure. Donald Trump said something that needs, no matter what story you're going with, if Donald Trump says something stupid,
that's what it's going to lead. Uh-huh. And, you know, they used to, you know, with local news, they always joke, if it bleeds, it leads, mm-hmm. you know. And that we grew up in a time when that was different.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
At three stations.
Yeah, three networks. And you had nightly news.
And they were not concerned with ratings. They were they were provided funding by the government. And they, so, you know, they're,
they did not sensationalize. And if you didn't have credibility, you didn't have anything. I mean, you think, well, you think of Walter Cronkite. I mean, people tuned to him. They believed him more than they believed he was the most believable man in America.
Yeah, well, you had Edward Murrow, who, Edward Murrow, guys like that. And I don't believe we have people like that today.
That level of trust. And
I think the last person, I don't know, maybe Peter Jennings, maybe... I don't know. You
not
know,
Brian
I,
Williams.
No, even Brian Williams, who, you know, I think is a trustworthy guy. But anyway, the point being, you know, that's a side note. I got a little carried off there. But, you know, you think about what Hearst was doing. It's really not much different than what Rupert Murdoch's doing today.
Right. Well, and like I said, you had every – there was a lot of competition because every city there wasn't the internet. There, you know, every
right.
winning radio stations at this point – every city had, you know, multiple newspapers. They were in competition with each other. And
what they were doing to Mr. Arbuckle here is they were portraying him as this lecher who used his weight to overpower these innocent girls. Mm-hmm. And in reality, he was a good-natured man, and he was so shy with women that he was regarded by those who knew him as, and one person called him this, the most chaste man in pictures. And, you know, so mm-hmm. He really did not have this coming. Mm-hmm. His lifestyle did. But the newspapers, they whipped everybody up into such a frenzy that you had a prosecutor out in San Francisco where this happened, Matthew Brady. Now, this Brady's in, and there ain't nothing worse than a politically ambitious prosecutor.
That's true. And that's why I really think that should be an appointed office, because... prosecutors will often use a story such as this, you know, facts be damned, if they can get, you know, if they can get some votes out of it, high profile cases like that. That's why I really think it should be a prosecutor should be an appointed office and not an elective office.
Well, we see it here. I mean, we have one of the most outspoken prosecutors you think you're going to see across the country, mm-hmm. locally in Hamilton County. And a lot of lawyers think that is, you know, something a prosecutor should not be doing. Now, a prosecutor, you know, it's but anyway, again, there ain't nothing worse than a politically ambitious prosecutor. And this guy, Brady, had planned to run for governor. Mm-hmm. So before trials, before anything, he's already out there making public pronouncements about his guilt. He's pressuring witnesses to make false statements. And as I said, first, he used Delmont, the lady, as a star witness during the indictment, which, you know, the indictment phase is fairly easy.
Yeah. They say you can indict a ham sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. But he refused to, he would not put her on the stand in the first trial. And she never did testify, but...
She was a questionable... She was a questionable character.
The judge threatened Brady with the dismissal of the case because he would not put her on. Now, Delmont herself, she had a long criminal record. She had multiple convictions of racketeering, bigamy, fraud, and extortion, and was allegedly making a living by luring men into compromising positions and capturing them in photographs to be used as evidence in divorce proceedings.
Yeah.
So this woman, she was a criminal.
Yes.
That's what she was.
She wasn't.
And they did not want to get her on the stand to tell, because she was, at this point, she is the only person who's saying Fatty Arbuckle did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And the manager. The manager's trying to get some money.
Mm-hmm.
So the defense, they also got a letter from Delmont admitting to a plan to extort payment from Arbuckle. So, in view of a constantly changing story or testimony, when it ended any chance of it going to trial. Now, ultimately, the judge found no evidence of rape. But after hearing testimony from one of the party guests, Ms. Zay Previn, she said that Rapay told her, "Roscoe hurt me." This was on her deathbed, not Previn's deathbed, but Ms. Rapay's deathbed. She allegedly told her, "Roscoe hurt me." And the judge decided that Arbuckle could be charged with first-degree murder. Brady...
And that goes back to... We talked about this in the...
The deathbed thing.
Yeah, the deathbed.
Now, this woman loaded up with morphine. She liable to say, yeah. Kermit the Frog hurt me.
Yeah, or she, in her mind, he's trying to help her. She is on morphine.
Well, he may have hurt her. He may have picked her up in the bed and laid her down wrong. And, got a sore back.
But like you said, she was... Obviously, she was on morphine. He may have been trying to help her. She may have perceived it as he was trying to hurt her. It's hard to tell.
But she could have been. That could have been anything. Any number of things.
It's hearsay. It's not something that testified to. It was with what.
Now Brady originally wanted the death penalty. He wanted a trial. They indicted him. He was going to take him to trial. He wanted the death penalty. But the judge said no. He reduced it to manslaughter, which in this case would be woman slaughter. But
yeah.
Anyway, so they're going to trial, and this is September 17th, 1921. And look how quickly the wheels of justice are turning here.
Man, they did those days. They would have
September 5th. We're talking about September 5th is when this happened. 12 days later, he's having he's arrested, arraigned, charged with manslaughter, and given bail after 3 weeks in jail. Now, the trial begins a month later in the city courthouse in San Francisco. Gavin McNabb, he is the lawyer for Arbuckle.
Mm-hmm.
The principal witness is this Ms. Zay Previn, who was a guest at the party, who said, you know, heard the deathbed talk. And at the beginning of the trial, Arbuckle told his already estranged wife, Minta Durfee, that he did not harm or pay. And she believed him, and she showed up in the courtroom to support him. But public feeling was so negative that she was later shot at while entering the courthouse.
His wife.
Yeah, his wife was. She was shot at entering the courthouse. Now, Brady brings his first witness up. This is a lady named Betty Campbell. She's a model. She attended the September 5th party, and she testified that she saw Arbuckle with a smile on his face hours after the alleged rape occurred. Another one, Grace Holtzen. She was a nurse.
Well, what kind of evidence is that? You saw a smile.
A smile on his face. Exactly. You got a nurse who, Grace Holtzen. She's a nurse who testified that it was very likely that Arbuckle did rape Miss Rapay and bruise her body in the process. And then here's another one. Dr. Edward Heinrich. He did not invent the Heinrich maneuver. That was...
I was biting my tongue.
Yeah, that was Joseph Heinrich. But anyway, he was a local criminologist who claimed that he found Arbuckle's fingerprints smeared with Rapay's blood on a door in room 1219. Dr. Arthur Beadsley, the hotel doctor, testified that an external force, meaning a champagne bottle, an exceptionally large penis, whatever, may have damaged the bladder. So,
speculation.
Complete speculation. So, now Dr. Heinrich's claim to have found fingerprints was cast into doubt after McNabb, his lawyer, produced the St. Francis Hotel maid who testified that she had cleaned the room before the investigation even took place, and there was no blood on the bathroom floor.
Okay, so there was no blood and no bloody fingerprints.
So he just made that up. It just didn't happen. Dr. Beardsley admitted that Rapay had never mentioned being assaulted while he treated her. McNabb's lawyer was able to further get Nurse Holtzen, the one I said to remember, to admit that the rupture of her bladder could have been a result of cancer and the bruises on her body could have been a result of some heavy-ass jewelry. I mean, she must have had some serious bling on that evening, but it could have been a result of the jewelry that she was just wearing. So, during the defense stage of this trial, McNabb's calling all kinds of pathology experts in, and, you know, they're saying how it could have been ruptured, and there was no external cause for the rupture. So, finally, Arbuckle comes up to testify for himself, and he's pretty simple. He's direct. He's not flustered. His story was that Miss Rapay, who he said he'd known for 5 or 6 years, came into the room around noon that day, and that sometime afterwards, Miss May Tobb asked him for a ride into town. So he went into the room where Miss Rapay was in to change clothes and discovered her vomiting in the toilet. So he said that she told him that she felt ill and asked to lie down. And then he carried her into a bedroom. Now, that could have been the part where she said, Roscoe hurt me. Mm-hmm. If her bladder and everything's messing up, mm-hmm. being carried's going to hurt. Anyway, when Arbuckle and a few of the guests reentered the room, they found Miss Rapay on the floor doing that tearing at her clothing thing that she had done in the past.
Right.
And going into violent convulsions. Now, to calm her down, they put her in a bathtub of cool water. Arbuckle and Fishback, one of the guys that went with him, they took her up to room 1227 and called the hotel manager and doctor. Dr. Claire said she was just drunk. And now Arbuckle and this Tob lady go into town. So that's what he's got to say. So they've heard all the evidence, everything else. And the jury comes back 5 days, they're deadlocked, 44 hours of deliberation here, with a 10-2 not guilty verdict. So they had to declare a mistrial. Now, Arbuckle's attorneys, and it's kind of funny and interesting, really, later concentrated their attention on a woman named Helen Hubbard who had told the jury she would vote guilty until hell freezes over. Now, she refused to look at the exhibits, read transcripts. She'd made up her mind in the courtroom. Here's where it's interesting. Her husband, this Hubbard lady, who said no matter what, he's guilty.
Right.
He was a lawyer who did business with the DA's office and was surprised that she wasn't even challenged when selected for the jury pool.
So she's married to someone working at the DA's office?
Working with the DA's office, who's a lawyer, and says, I can't believe she even got picked for the trial.
So she had her mind made up even before the trial started.
Yeah. Now, the second trial said that it was basically the same as the first, really, except one of the key witnesses, Ms. Pravon, Zev Perone, testified that Brady, this ambitious prosecutor, had forced her to lie. Now, another witness during the first trial, a security guard named Jesse Norgard, who worked at Culver City Studios where Arbuckle made his movies, testified that Arbuckle had once showed up at the studio and offered him a cash bribe in exchange for the key to Rapay's room, dressing room.
So he's going to this guard and say, let me have the key to her dressing room. He wants in it.
Yeah.
Well, that looks bad.
That looks bad. But he's Arbuckle is telling the security guard that he wanted to play a joke on the actress. Norgard says he refused and was given the key. But then during cross-examination, Norgard's testimony's questioned. When it's revealed that he was an ex-con who was charged with sexually assaulting an 8-year-old girl and was looking for a sentence reduction from Brady in exchange for this testimony.
Okay, so he...
So again, nothing worse than an ambitious prosecutor. I mean, this
another very questionable witness.
Yeah, now the second trial discredited a lot of the evidence that was in the first trial, his, you know, fingerprints on the hotel bedroom door. And Heinrich took back his earlier testimony about the fingerprint, and he said it was likely faked. The defense was so convinced that the prosecution had not even put up a case that Arbuckle didn't even testify. He just said, you know, we'll let this stand is on its own.
Right.
You know, you're not compelled. Unfortunately, the jurors took this not testifying as a sign of something to hide.
You know, that is always any type of criminal trial. That's always the big question, is whether or not you let the defendant testify. Because
you're opening a can of worms. When you have, you know, the problem is that we all live lives that we do not want under a microscope.
Right.
I mean, unless you're Dottie Scott, you don't want your life examined too hard or too closely. I will say this, and I don't want to, you know, I know we have some young listeners occasionally, and I don't want to disillusion them, but even the colonel has made mistakes in his past.
I can't believe that.
I got a skeleton or two in my closet.
So it is easy to, over in any cross-examination, to bring up details of the past or conflicting conflicting testimony.
Well, and when you get on the stand, you don't know what he's liable to say. And at this point, the lawyers are sitting there thinking they haven't proven anything. They backtracked on everything.
This was, it was in the 1920s, but you will seldom see in any major trial today famous court case today, it'll be seldom when they let the defendant testify. There's too many things that can go wrong,
and it's very difficult. And now with all the evidence they can gather, it's all DNA stuff and fiber evidence, and either they have it or they don't. Mm-hmm. If they have it, you're convicted. If they don't, you know.
It's hard to come out of it. All you can do is hurt yourself for the most part.
Well, my uncle, who was a police lieutenant, I have two of them, and my uncle told me one time, you are never going to help yourself by talking to the police, because all you can do is tell them something that's going to hurt you. And the example he said was, we're going down a rabbit hole here, but I'm going to go there anyway. He had to investigate a lot of murders. He was a detective. And he said, do you know how many we caught by them trying to prove they were innocent? He said, if they would have kept their mouth shut, we could have never proven they were guilty. But what we could prove is that they were lying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if a police officer comes up to me and asks me, where were you on the night of Tuesday the 10th? And I say, I was here. Who saw you there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was at home watching TV. You know, I was at home watching TV by myself. But if you say something, now the burden of proof that you're telling the truth is on you.
Mm-hmm. And it can easily be
turned around. And if you're going to lie about that, you'll lie about something else.
Yeah.
So you're better off just to not say anything.
The favorite thing for a prosecutor is to be able to put you in a position where they say, catch you misrepresenting something, where they can say, well, were you lying then or were you lying now?
Exactly. Exactly. When are you lying?
Your credibility is shot.
Now, this time, because he did not testify, even though the evidence was overwhelmingly showed that he didn't do anything, they made a tactical error in not letting him on the stand, but they were still deadlocked. But this time it was a reverse. It was a 10-2 guilty verdict.
Okay, so it was still hung jury.
Still a hung jury.
But this time the jury was leaning toward conviction.
Oh, very much so. And now this just scared the hell out of his lawyers. They thought, okay, that was a tactical mistake. We ain't going to do that again.
Well, I mean, it just goes to show you how a jury, you get 12 different people, you never know what's going to happen.
Right, and you never know if you got, you know, six people that got, you know, very, I don't know, timid personalities and a couple dominant personalities.
Right.
But anyway, so this prosecutor, he ain't giving up. He ain't giving up at all.
A lot of cases are won or lost at the selection of the jury.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and so that now they got a third trial, Timmy.
Yeah.
Third trial,
can you imagine the stress involved going through?
Well, and by the
three
time
murder trials,
by the time of this third one, His film had been banned. The newspapers have been filled with the past months with stories of Hollywood orgies, murder, sexual perversion. This Delmont lady, she toured the country giving one-woman shows as the woman who signed the murder charge against Arbuckle and lecturing people. Now, this is a woman with a long criminal history lecturing people on the evils of Hollywood.
So. This was before the theory of any publicity is good publicity.
Exactly. So this time, the defense said, you know, we ain't taking any chances. They took a very, very aggressive defense. They tore apart the prosecution's case with just really long and brutal and aggressive cross-examinations of each witness. And he got, finally, McNabb got evidence in about Miss Rapace's very lurid past and her medical history that he could not get in the first time. And another hole was opened up
including
in the case.
Including the abortions and
the abortions, the drinking, the promiscuity. Mm-hmm. And another thing where they blew a big hole in the case was Zay Previn, a key witness. She was out of the country after fleeing police custody. And she was wanted by the police for something else and couldn't testify.
So she left Dodge. She got out of Dodge, and she wasn't.
So it doesn't look good when the witnesses against you are running from the police.
Right,
you know,
right.
So with the first
a lot of questionable characters for the witnesses.
Well, you know, the only decent person in this whole case is Arbuckle.
Exactly.
I mean, the rest of them just some slimy rat bastards. So Arbuckle testified, and his story was the same. And during the closing argument,
so the third time he does testify.
He takes a stand, same thing he says in the first. But in the closing ones, McNabb just, because in the first trial, McNabb, his lawyer, didn't even make closing statements. Mm-hmm. He just sat there and said, they didn't even make a case for anything. Mm-hmm. I ain't even justifying, you know, mm-hmm. what they said. Well, this time he said, you know what, he just ripped him apart. He went through every flaw in the case from the very start, how District Attorney Brady fell for these outlandish charges by Ms. Delmont, and who McNabb, and this really, you know, kind of hit the nail on the head, the complaining witness who never witnessed, you know, because mm-hmm. they wouldn't put her on the stand.
Right.
So the jury began deliberations April 12th. It took 6 minutes to return with a unanimous not guilty. 5 of those minutes was spent writing a formal statement of apology to Arbuckle for putting him through the whole ordeal.
And the jury wrote him an apology.
The jury did. It was a very dramatic move. And the jury statement is read by the jury foreman stated. This is what the jury said. Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle. We feel that a great injustice has been done to him. We feel that also that it was not only our plain duty to give him this exoneration under the evidence, for there was not the slightest proof adduced to connect him in any way with the commission of any crime. He was manly throughout the case and told a straightforward story on the witness stand, which we all believed. The happening at the hotel was an unfortunate affair for which Mr. Arbuckle, so the evidence shows, was in no way responsible. We wish him success and hope that the American people will take the judgment of 14 men and women who sat listening for 31 days to evidence that Roscoe Arbuckle is entirely innocent and free of all blame. Now, after they read this, the jury foreman walks over and personally hands it to him. And Arbuckle kept this for the rest of his life. He treasured this. And then each juror came over and shook his hand. And then the jurors actually asked to get their pictures taken with him.
Selfies.
They were the first selfies. So they were the first.
They recognized
what had happened to the poor man. And experts kind of now think that her bladder, Miss Rapace's bladder, that's what she really died of, mm-hmm. The peritonitis from the bladder. They believe that it was a result of an abortion she might have had just a short time before that party. Unfortunately, her organs had been destroyed, and it was not possible to test to see if she had been pregnant recently. Now, The one thing Arbuckle was forced to plead guilty to was violating the Volstead Act.
For the alcohol.
The alcohol for prohibition. Mm-hmm. He had to pay a $500 fine. But now think about this. The man has done nothing. At the time of his acquittal, he owed his lawyers over $700,000. In today's dollars, that's almost $10 million in legal fees for these three. He had to sell his house, his car. Yeah, I mean, he ended up, he didn't end up broke because he had that
success.
Yeah, but even though he was charged of all of them, it killed his popularity among the general public. And Will Hayes, excuse me there, Will Hayes, who served as the head of this newly formed Motion Pictures Distributors and Producers of America Censor Board, cited Arbuckle as an example of the poor morals in Hollywood. Now you got all these people who are just the seediest ass people you're ever gonna meet. The prosecutor, Hearst, everybody else. The only decent person in the whole damn story is Arbuckle. And they cite him as an example of poor morals.
I think is what he was guilty of was throwing a party, basically.
Yeah. And inviting the wrong person who's gonna die. This woman was gonna die whether she was walking down the street or at that party, no matter what she was gonna do. This guy also banned Arbuckle from ever working in movies again. Yeah. So he had to lift the ban, but
But the principal effect of the trial was Arbuckle was basically shunned by Hollywood, and there was even though the ban was lifted, there were no acting roles coming his way. And not only that, a secondary effect of it was the archival history of his films. They were destroyed. All the films that starring Arbuckle were destroyed. In November 1923, Minta Durfee, Arbuckle's wife, filed for divorce. The divorce was granted in January 1924. They had been separated since 1921, but Durfee always claimed that he was innocent, and she claimed he was the nicest man in the world, and they remained friends the rest of his life. They did try to reconcile, but it just didn't work out. Arbuckle went on to remarry Doris Dean in May 16, 1925. He tried filmmaking, but again, the industry was real resistant to distributing his pictures, so he was continued to be just shunned even after his acquittal. He began to drink more. Words of his first wife, Roscoe, she is quoted, "Roscoe only seemed to find solace in the comfort of a bottle." Buster Keaton attempted to help Arbuckle by giving him some work in his films, and Arbuckle wrote a short for Keaton called Daydreams in 1922. He appeared in some shorts with Buster Keaton and Rudolph Valentino, Douglas Fairbanks, and Jackie Coogan, but was never again the star that he once was. He even went to do some directing under an alias of William Goodrich, which was his father's first and middle name, William Goodrich Arbuckle. So between 1924 and 1932, Arbuckle directed a number of comedy shorts under the name William Goldrich, but they were with lesser-known comics, and they just didn't do very well. But finally, in 1932, Arbuckle signed a contract with Warner Brothers to star under his own name again in a series of six two-reel comedies. And then, even though they were released here in the United States, it starred not only Arbuckle, but also Shrimp Howard from Three Stooges. They were released here in the United States. They were very successful. But when the Warner Brothers attempted to release them in the United Kingdom, The British Board of Film Censors cited the 10-year-old scandal and refused to grant them an exhibition certificate, so he couldn't, even though he was appearing in some shorts and scraping by a living, those would not be, they were not allowed to be released anywhere but the United States. But on June 28th, 1933, was a big day for Arbuckle. He signed with Warner Brothers again to make a feature-length film. So this was his, this was going to be his big comeback film. On June 28, 1933, he went out to, with his friends to celebrate his first wedding anniversary and this signing of this contract with Warner Brothers for his first feature-length film in over 10 years. He said it was the best day of his life. Unfortunately, that evening he suffered a heart attack and died later that night in his sleep. That was on January 29th, 1933. He was 46 years old. His widow, Addie, requested that his body be cremated, as was Arbuckle's wish.
They had to build a big bonfire for him.
Yeah, I did. For his contribution to the film industry, Roscoe Arbuckle now has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame on Hollywood Boulevard. So, very long and sad story to one of the true giants.
You know, it is. I mean, think about the irony of this is the best day of my life. He finally gets his stuff back.
Yeah.
And drops over dead.
Drops over dead of a heart attack.
And, you know, at 46, you had to kind of see it coming, but...
Yeah, and even when, you know, even he was in his 30s when he went through that trial. I can imagine the stress involved in that. Someone who was a drinker, overweight, you know, it had to, three murder trials had to take a toll. It would take a toll on anybody, but especially someone who has health problems to begin with.
But at that time, 1933, you know, if you, they didn't have the Lipitor, they didn't have anything else. He was going to, you know, and he wasn't eating right, and...
Well, what they say, you can, I think, what Eddie Murphy say, you can be old or you can be fat, but you can't be both.
Can't be both.
Right.
Can't be both.
So, sad story, Fatty Arbuckle.
Well, and hopefully, because, you know, when most people hear Fatty Arbuckle, what you think of is the guy who raped the woman. Yeah. If you know anything about it, you think about the guy who raped the woman with a champagne bottle, when in fact... None of that occurred.
No.
And it, you know, this story reminds me very much of Sam Shepard.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sam Shepard later, now, years and years later, the DNA are showing that we can do DNA, are showing that Sam Shepard was actually telling the truth, that there was a third person in that bedroom.
It reminds me sort of the McMartin daycare.
That was just like a Salem witch hunt.
And you had these people's lives that were just totally destroyed on faulty testimony or questionable testimony from questionable witnesses. And
well, and one thing that we have, you know, we know for sure. You know, we've seen over and over, and I don't think it's, I can only speak to America. I can't say it's an American thing because, you know, it happens other places in the world. But because we have such freedom of the press and you know, things mm-hmm. like that, we have no problems tearing people apart, regardless of the fact of whether they're innocent or guilty, before we even know they're innocent or guilty.
And I think it's especially true of celebrities. There's this, we like to, the press loves to build people up to tear them down. And what? That was, you know, an early example of that.
You know, Timmy, one of my favorite quotes, and you know there's a musician I admire greatly, probably the greatest songwriter in American history, is Bruce Springsteen.
And I've heard you mention that.
There's a quote by John Lennon that said, God help Bruce Springsteen when they decide to, they've made him a god, God help him when they decide to tear him down.
Mm-hmm.
And Well, and that was John Lennon after what he had gone through with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see it. I guarantee you'll see it during this election year. Right now, it's Ben Carson is kind of gaining on Trump, and you have Marco Rubio. They all become at one point the flavor of the month, and what was the quote in? What was Primary Callers? Where the quote, I think it was. The media giveth and the media taketh away. And you'll certainly see that as we go through this cycle. That was certainly the case with Fatty Arbuckle, an early example of that, where a man's life was just totally destroyed by an unfortunate situation that he was just around and people trying to profit from it. So kind of a sad story, a sad note, but an interesting and cautionary tale.
A cautionary tale. Do not get... Once you become too famous, nothing good can happen to you.
So when I go to San Francisco, I'm only getting one hotel room.
Don't get three.
Don't get three.
One for the hookers and one for your friends. Get one hotel room.
Well, sometimes the hooker and friends are one and the same.
But you only need one room.
Exactly.
You don't need three. Anytime, nothing good can happen of renting more than one hotel room.
Yeah, you're probably right.
The only time that works is when you got your three kids with you and you say, I'm tired of dealing with these little urchins and I'm putting them in one room and me and the missus are staying in the other, or me and Rudy are staying in the other room. But that's the only time it works out.
You know, some weird stuff that happens in hotel rooms. I mean, not just the sexual stuff. I mean, there's a lot of unsolved murders and stuff that happens.
You know, I was just reading about Bob Crane.
Yeah.
I believe you just posted something on Facebook, on the History Dweeb's Facebook about Bob Crane.
Yeah.
I mean, just hotels are...
Devil's Workshop.
They are the devil's plaything. They're the devil's playground.
Yeah, they are.
And that's why the colonel... I know people all over the country, and when I got to stay, I just call up one of my friends and say, can I stay above your garage?
So you do a lot of couch surfing.
I do not mind sleeping in my car in that driveway. I do not.
I'm sure bad things happen at rest stops as well. Colonel, where can people find us?
You can look. The best place to find us is on Facebook, and you can follow the links there. Do we have a permanent link to iTunes on Facebook?
No, but you can just search for us on iTunes.
Search for us. Go on iTunes. Search for History Dweebs. We really, as we said earlier, and not to belabor a point, and you know what? You know what's been nice about today? Speaking of belabor and a point, the devil hasn't been here to beat that dead horse the whole time.
I know. Well, you know, she's in that home incarceration thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if she'll be out before our next podcast or not.
Probably. Oh, you know her husband just got to be pulling his hair.
I'm sure he's getting the best attorneys in the world.
To get her released.
Or to get her convicted. One or the other.
Put her in jail or let her free, but don't keep her here.
Yeah, you know, she won't be too bad if you have that plexiglass between you, you know.
If she could talk to you on the phone.
Yeah.
But, you know, she got that harpy voice.
Yeah.
She got that harpy screech that she uses.
She would look good in orange, Joe. She would look good in orange.
She would look good in orange.
Yeah,
she got the hair to match it.
So, Brandy, we hope you're released soon. And if not, we'll certainly come and visit you, maybe put a few dollars on your commissary. And, Brittany, you keep, one day at a time.
One day at a time, Brittany. You know, she was so close to having that 1 week chip.
Yes.
And then Friday came.
Friday will get you every time.
Yeah, well, she had the 3 day chip, and then Friday came.
Let's say a shout out to Knut and
Storm. Knut, how you doing? It's Knut and Storm.
And Storm over there in Norway. Thank you for continuing to listen.
Yeah, I imagine the weather's getting a little bit chillier up there now.
Send us some pictures when it starts to snow. For everyone, check us out on Facebook. We got a lot of interesting stuff out there. Leave us some comments. Please leave us a review on iTunes. And we'll see you all again real soon on History Dweebs.
Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye, everyone.